And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning is Dr. Andrew Shapiro, who's the manager of technology formulation for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. And Jet Propulsion Laboratory has been knocking out some of the most extraordinary feats of engineering since the early 1960s. We're going to be talking with Dr. Shapiro about new technological concepts and what it's like to manage a lab where ideas become concepts, possibly projects, and even part of a mission for robotic and manned space exploration. Dr. Shapiro, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
John, thank you. It's great to be back.
Yeah, and we've been looking forward to this conversation. You're responsible for a number of organizations, and one of those being, and I'll just name the acronym, NIAC, N-I-A-C, NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts. Can you tell us about that particular group and this nomination process that takes place annually?
Sure. I'm just responsible for the NIAC at JPL. NIAC itself is a NASA headquarters-sponsored program. They send out a call every year, a call for proposals, and it goes out to anybody who feels that they're qualified to propose something innovative for NASA. They have some rules in the call about what something innovative is, and these are for missions or possible missions that would go 20, 30 years in the future, very far out, far-reaching missions that are disruptive and completely different from anything that NASA is generally considering on their decadal planning horizon.
Right. So a person or a team of people can propose something that they've come up, let's say, with a new propulsion system, let's say, for an example. And it's not tied to any particular mission, but then somebody could look at some long-range requirements of NASA and say, geez, there's a problem I think I can address. There's a challenge that I think I can provide a technological concept for. So do they have this idea of things that NASA's looking for so that they can propose something specific?
Well, NASA does publish something called the Decadal Surveys, or their interpretation of these decadal surveys with the National Academy of Sciences. But NIACs are even beyond that. These are ideas that are beyond what the NASA current thinking is, and that's what makes them really interesting. So they look at the call is for things that don't necessarily exist in the current NASA thinking. These are kind of disruptive concepts that are completely innovative. And it's fortunate at JPL because at JPL I get to just corral these concepts from folks across the laboratory. And they have just the most amazing ideas. And really it's my job just to funnel them into the concepts so that they can win the proposals. The proposals, there are kind of two phases of proposals that NASA puts out calls for each year. The first one is called a phase one, which is about $125,000. And that's just a paper study to see if some far-out idea is even feasible. And they've done some preliminary numbers, maybe what we call back-of-the-envelope calculation, to say, yeah, physics kind of works on this, we think. And that gives them a chance to do a study that actually looks at the details and see whether the mission is even plausible. If that turns out to be successful, then they can propose something called a phase two. And the requirement for a phase two is winning a phase one and completing it, completing the study. Phase twos are a little bit longer. They're $500,000 and for over 2 years. And they are sponsoring a much more in-depth study, and it has to be on the same topic that this phase one study was done on.
Andrew, I'm wondering, before we get into some of these projects that you're working on, I'm curious about JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory. In general, if you look at the names of people involved in some of your teams, it looks like you have got it really dialed on the diversity, including you've got people from all over the world, it looks like, just judging on the names involved in your projects. And I'm wondering, I mean, first of all, you must have the greatest job in the world, but what other requests for proposal do you respond to? I mean, NASA, no doubt, is what you, those kind of projects you're working on mainly. But who else? I mean, do you do any projects for SpaceX or, you know, any of these other companies?
No, we do on occasion. And thank you, Lynn. I agree with you. I do have probably one of the most fun jobs in the world. No, we typically just respond to NASA. There's about, I don't know, 5 or 10% of the work that the laboratory does for other agencies, DOD or Department of Energy. Sometimes we kind of act on a consulting basis for some of those things. But 90% of our business or so is really directed at NASA. In my role, I look at both responding to NASA calls, and there are several that are along the innovation lines. And then also we have internal funds that we use for developing concepts that we think will help NASA in the future. So we kind of look both internally and externally, externally being our NASA headquarters sponsor.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you first about globetrotting on Titan, which is one of Saturn's moons, and a little project that you're working on called, it's the FAR, the Flying Amphibious Robot, and how you navigate Titan's, or how you propose to navigate Titan's rugged cliffs and all of the terrain that you need to explore to be able to bring back information from.
Yes, this is a great proposal. So I'm overseeing a team run by a principal investigator named Ali Aga, who's a young, relatively new hire. I think he's only been at JPL a couple years. And he had this just amazing concept that you could create a spacecraft that was kind of a sphere to start with when it landed, and then breaks into smaller parts as needed. So it kind of lands, in this case he's showing using a parachute on Titan, and then breaks itself apart, and then the pieces go off to explore. So each piece could be looked at like a quadcopter on a portion of something that looks like a soccer ball. So think of one of the segments of a soccer ball coming off with four propellers underneath and then flying around to explore different aspects of Titan. Not only can it explore the atmosphere, which on Titan is going to be pretty thick and soupy, also quite cold. It's about 100 Kelvin on the surface of Titan. But also Titan has amazing lakes that have seasons that come and go. So the lakes are very large in the springtime, and they dry up over the summer. And we've got images of lakes shrinking tremendously, so that it's a very interesting region. These little, I think Ali called them shapeshifters, actually, he could send them even under the methane lakes, actually into the lake itself and go submarining, exploring down, looking for vents and that kind of thing. It's really quite an incredible concept.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Andrew Shapiro. He's the manager of technology formulation for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Dr. Shapiro, I wanted to ask you, besides soliciting ideas from all the talented scientists and engineers at JPL, and of course the special relationship that your organization has with Caltech, how do you also work, interface, and get ideas from the business community and other universities around the world?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, John. Part of our job is really to partner with business and universities to get the best ideas. Our job as a federally funded research laboratory is not to do things that businesses can already do. So if we're making something and we think that a business exists that can make that or has already made that, our goal is to make sure that that business makes those for us and supplies them to us. So we strongly encourage businesses to work with us, and as they get to the point where they can manufacture the kind of strange things that we need for our different missions in these extreme environments, they start to manufacture those, and hopefully there will be multiple businesses that will function in this way. So we love to partner. In fact, it's our goal to spin out as much as possible to industry so that the rest of the space community, SpaceX and the large contractors as well, can use the technologies that we develop on the taxpayers' money.
Yeah, fascinating. In April of last year, you and I spoke. We had an interview on this program in talking about the current NIAC projects in Phase 1 and Phase 2. And honestly, one of those, I mean, they were all very interesting, but one of those really blew my mind, and that was a proposal by John Brophy, one of your brilliant scientists, who came up with a way of using our own sun as a lens for a very powerful telescope. A couple questions. One is, did that make it through the funding process, one? And two, is that something which the physics has been proven on? And maybe you could give a brief description of what this is.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And the answer to your question is yes. It's a combination of actually two different proposals, which is kind of interesting. And both of the proposals made it through our system. One, as you mentioned, is by John Brophy. John's a fellow here at JPL, one of our most senior researchers. And his concept is actually for the propulsion to get the telescope where it needs to be. The telescope itself is the brainchild of a brilliant scientist named Slava Turgiev. And the idea behind this, if from last year, these are both now in the Phase 2 realm, is that Slava proposed that if you put a 1-meter telescope at the Oort cloud, which is about 550 AU or astronomical units, the distance from the Earth to the Sun, beyond the sun, this is well outside of the solar system. If you put a 1-meter telescope out at the Oort cloud and use the sun as a lens, you could image something on the opposite side of the sun, directly opposite to where the telescope was. So if you line the telescope up with the sun acts as a spherical lens. You use an occulter on the telescope to block out the sunlight itself, and that's a whole technology on its own. But then the light rays from objects on a line directly behind the sun from the direction of the telescope can come into a focal line along the opposite edge where you have the telescope. And what Slava was able to prove was that you could image an exoplanet on a distant star to the resolution of something like 1 kilometer. It's just incredible. So you could actually see whether there were trees or anything like that growing, or whether you could actually determine whether there's a civilization on an exoplanet at that kind of magnification scale. It's well beyond anything that we're doing right now. Right now, typically an exoplanet is 1 pixel on a giant CCD array imager.
So the Kepler Space Telescope will identify some candidates or confirm some candidates for exoplanets, and then something like this would be able to go in with extraordinary resolution to be able to check out the biology to see if there's the type of stuff for sustaining life. Is that correct?
That's correct. It would probably contain a spectrometer of some kind, so it would look for particular signatures that we know would be associated with life. Yeah. John Brophy's contribution to this, which is really interesting also, is how to get something out to 550 AU. That is a huge journey. Right now, we've just been able to the two Voyager spacecraft just a year or two ago just departed the solar system, which are the first man-made objects to leave the solar system, which was a huge achievement by the laboratory here, and we're quite excited about that. But we're talking about something that's 100 times where these spacecraft have gone. And so it's really quite incredible how far they would have to go. John came up with a unique kind of propulsion system, which involves two components. One of them is a space-based high-powered laser, which has not been done yet, but we have high-powered lasers for various scientific purposes, and we also are able to put them in space. We've not done that, though. But then what he used is a shield, if you will, that the laser's pointed at, a set of solar cells, and the solar cell shield combination actually takes the light, converts it to electricity, which runs a giant ion engine, which he predicts could actually bring the spacecraft out to 550 AU in less than 15 years.
And just a quick note to our listeners, if this is confusing, using the sun as a lens to focus photons, let me just simply say that our telescopes today Hubble does not take an item and magnify it. Hubble collects light. That's what Hubble does. And this sort of telescope would do the same. It's grabbing photons. So at 550 astronomical units, that's where the photons come into a focal point. So I just wanted to mention that to our listeners, because it's very, very challenging to get your arms around this.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that definitely helps clarify, John.
Oh, it's also fascinating. So you've talked a little bit about John Brophy and Ali Agha, some of your most brilliant scientists working on these projects. And I'm wondering about when these guys and gals come up with these ideas, you know, their creativity is backed by this. Well, is it backed by predictability on you know, whether or not the development of some of these ideas that they're conceiving, you know, can come to fruition? What is the process behind that, you know, and how many ideas of, you know, John Brophy or Ali Agha or anyone else get killed right at inception?
Well, that's a great question, Lynn. We have several processes, but people are by no means assured that their concept's going to move forward. And that, I guess, is a lot of my job, is to help sort that out and help these brilliant scientists look at their concepts and help them shape them into a point where they could become feasible missions. I remember a couple of years ago, my supervisor had put out a call lab-wide for innovative ideas. He got more than 700 responses, and I helped sort through those. It was the response was incredible, and many, many of them were extremely good ideas. So we have plenty of creativity at the laboratory. The idea is how do we sort these things so that we can make them into useful science gathering concepts that will move forward. For this last NIAC call, I think we had around 30 or 35 concepts, and those were just from the people who had the time to put in a concept. And we have a little review team, so usually I convene a board of some senior people, and we sit down with each of the proposers and go through their concept and say, is this really, one, is it feasible? We have somebody who kind of double-checks the physics and make sure that the physics makes sense, at least at a top level. The second thing we do is we see if they are responsive to the call. A lot of times we have really, really interesting concepts, but they're just not appropriate for what NASA is asking for. NASA is quite specific, and they want something that's a mission, something that's far out, something that's not on the existing plan. And so if it doesn't meet those requirements, we filter it out. Sometimes, and I've done this several times, we find really good concepts that are not appropriate for the call, But then we use some internal funds to sponsor their development just because we think it's a really good idea.
Hmm. I love that. And so some of those projects then sit on the shelf, or do they, you know, are they truly brought to a product that might be used in some other application?
Well, that's a great question. So what we try to do is progress them up of what we call the technology readiness chain. And these concepts for the NIACS, for instance, are really at a very low technology readiness level. They're typically kind of theoretical concepts, or basic physics has been proven, but not much beyond that. We try to look for funding sources. Suppose they win a NIAC call and they've done their full study, then we look for the next funding sources, and there are several that we go out. We have something called Center Innovation Funds, which I ran up until this year. I just handed it off to one of our senior managers. And the Center Innovation Fund is NASA-provided money, but it's distributed at the discretion of our chief technologist. And again, we have a proposal kind of reviewing process, and we've had proposals go from NIAC into Center Innovation Funds. If they go from the Center Innovation Funds and they're successful at developing a little more, usually that's a 1 or 2 year kind of project, then it'll propose into maybe something called a Game-Changing Development Fund, which is another NASA program. Internally, this is an internal NASA program from our Space Technology Mission Directorate, and those are a little larger. Those are several million dollars over several years, and those are really to bring something from a kind of benchtop demonstration to a serious prototype that might be proposed for a full mission. Mm-hmm. Once it goes from, suppose it got funded on one of these game-changing development programs, then it would be at the point where we start to look at how to infuse that onto the spacecraft. And what I've been doing with our teams here for the last several years is I won't even have them propose into a game-changing development program until they've really targeted a mission where this might go. Is it a Mars mission? Is it a Europa mission? Is it a Venus mission? And if they can really say, yeah, this is the really good technology that will make a difference for, say, a Venus mission, then we go ahead and develop that proposal and apply for funding from NASA to move it to the next stage.
We've had a number of conversations with folks out at JPL, and you know, I just keep shaking my head wondering what's in the drinking water out there. I mean, you've had all 10 Mariner spacecraft came from JPL, the Kepler Space Telescope, of course, that's confirming all these exoplanets. We had a guy named Adam Stelzner on who his team landed the Curiosity, a 2,000-pound, $2.5 billion rover, landed that safely on the surface of Mars. I mean, the engineering behind that. And then, of course, my favorite, which is the Cassini spacecraft that explored the Saturn system for 20 years. What is it about the Caltech JPL community that encourages so much innovation?
That's a good question. I've been trying to put my finger on that myself. The best that I can come up with is that when people are excited about the kinds of mission that JPL likes to do, they're excited about exploring other planets, other bodies in the solar system, and deep space, and even other solar systems. So it's just that kind of work that brings a certain kind of enjoyment and excitement to the job. So we get people who are really enthusiastic about space and space exploration. I think that's a key thing. The other nice thing here is that we have a pretty high-powered team. We have about one-third PhDs, one-third masters, and one-third bachelors for our technical staff. If you look at other aerospace companies and other ventures, very few of them are weighted this heavily in the high academic realm. So that encouragement is also helps this attitude at the laboratory. And I think the third thing is this relationship with Caltech. We spend a lot of time with the Caltech professors trying to understand what they're looking for and understanding the fundamental questions that they're asking. And we get a large number of students from Caltech that come work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, my father brought me into his office once, and he had this calculator that was the size of a suitcase. It probably weighed 50, 60, 70 pounds. It was totally mechanical. There was no electricity. There was no electrical circuits at all. It was this big mechanical calculator. And you have one of your projects, I think it's the Automaton rover, for the surface of Venus, where it's very, very harsh environment, and it eats up electronics almost on contact. So can you talk about that? This is sort of going back in technology to make something work in Venus's environment.
Yes, thank you, John. This is one we talked a little bit about last time when we chatted. This is by one of our young engineers named Jonathan Sauter. And what he did is he went back to look at the 18th century automatons. These were kind of extremely capable wind-up robots, if you will. They had ones with human hands with individual digits and individual knuckles and things like that that could grip things. These were all run by springs and pulleys and that kind of thing. And his idea was, well, this Venus environment is so rough that maybe the only thing that's going to survive any significant length of time is something that's pretty much all mechanical. So he proposed a little rover, a little six-legged rover, that really was entirely mechanical. And it was powered essentially by a wind-up spring, and the spring gets wound by a little fan that takes the breeze, if you will, and spins around and essentially winds up the spring so that the rover can walk around on the surface of Venus. Now, Venus, as you mentioned, is a very, very tough environment, about 490 degrees centigrade on the surface. It's at 90 bars, which is, I don't know, like several hundred feet under the ocean in terms of pressure. The atmosphere is sulfuric acid, various sulfur compounds. It's a very, very extreme, difficult environment to operate any kind of vehicle. There's really nothing equivalent on the Earth that is this difficult. And so we had to come up with new ways of figuring out how to work in this atmosphere. I've been working with Jonathan on this one, and we've come to the conclusion that he will need one little bit of electronics, and that is to transmit data from the various instruments that he would have on board up into a orbiting satellite that would transmit the data back to Earth. But he even proposed that you could actually send data kind of the way that they did in the Martian by pointing at different semaphores around in a circle or something like that. So it could actually, but that data rate is pretty slow. We think we can make a transmitter that's rugged enough to survive this environment, but everything else would be mechanical.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. We've always enjoyed our conversations with you, Dr. Shapiro, who's the manager of the technology formulation for Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I'll also mention Dr. Shapiro holds 12 patents and has applied for 8 additional ones. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Andrew.
Okay.
Thank you, Lynn.